Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Each week, our host David Hunt speaks to a leading startup CEO, executive, or thought leader in the clean tech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their clean tech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello, I'm David Hunt, CEO and founder of Hyperion Executive Search and your host for the Leaders in Clean Tech podcast. Now, before we start the episode, I'm going to do something I'm pretty uncomfortable with, but please bear with me. As a parent, you'll know that you'll do anything for your kids. Now, my son Alex has an incurable muscle-wasting condition called muscular dystrophy, and I try and raise funds to help find a cure where I can. And this time, I'm cycling 50 miles from Liverpool to Chester and back again on July the 4th. If you can spare a few pounds, dollars or euros, I'll put a link to my Just Giving page on the website for this episode. Please forgive me for asking, but I'm sure you'll appreciate I'll do anything for Alex. And if you can support, that's really appreciated, but equally, clearly, no obligation on anyone's behalf. But I thought I'd just throw that in and see if anyone can support. Listen, now let's get on to business. This week we look at geothermal energy for the home, as I speak with Michael Saxey, CEO of Dandelion Energy. Michael is an experienced executive who has previously scaled startups through periods of rapid growth. He was previously the CEO of Stardog and was entrepreneur in residence for the NEA and chief marketing officer for Opower, where he helped guide the company through its IPO and acquisition by Oracle. I hope that you enjoy the episode. Hello, Michael. It's good to have you with us to share your story and to discuss geothermal or ground source heat pumps, as perhaps they're better known in Europe at least. And it's somewhat surprising, given my passion for the electrification of pretty much everything, including heat, wherever possible, that you're our first guest from a geothermal company. So I'm really keen to talk about your technology and dig into that. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Now, I'm always intrigued as much by a person's or an entrepreneur's story as I am by the technology. And on the podcast, we sort of delve into both of those things. And it's customary for us to start with a little bit of your backstory. Now, we've had other guests in the past who've come out of Google Moonshot Factory. And so I'm keen to hear a little bit about the genesis of Dandelion as a company. But more importantly, I guess a little bit of your backstory in terms of how you came to find yourself in clean tech and how you came to join the team at Dandelion Energy.
Yeah. Sometimes people ask me for career advice, and I'm not sure I'm qualified to give it because I've followed such a circuitous route. I joined Dandelion a little over a year ago, came in because Kathy, our founder, wanted someone to deal with the unfortunate day-to-day logistics of running a company like this. But my story is, I'm a lawyer by training. I went to law school, came out of law school, worked at a law firm, decided that it was too long an apprenticeship and too little responsibility. I grew up in Washington, D.C., where I am now, and am the child of two bona fide do-gooders. and so that was always sort of in my DNA. Left the practice of law to run communications on a political campaign, which was a good proxy for the chaos and excitement of startups. Mm-hmm. And then joined a company called Opower right after that, where I knew the founders, and Opower's energy efficiency analytics for utilities, a B2B2C company. Okay. Your UK audience may know us from some of the stuff we've done with Eon there. Mm-hmm. And was there for a long time. We managed to take it public and sold it to Oracle. And for me, that was a tremendous education in both how fun it can be to grow a business, but also, the challenges and the peculiar patterns of doing it in the clean energy space.
Yeah.
And, so then after that, I became an entrepreneur in residence at NEA, a venture firm that had invested in Opower, and they'd also invested in Dandelion, and started to get to know Kathy and the team, and just was incredibly excited about the potential for what the company's doing.
Right. Right. So, yeah, no, it's always interesting to talk about those journeys for entrepreneurs, CEOs, founders, and they're rarely the sort of the linear paths that they might teach you in college. But, yeah, I think it's always those, as you touched on there, the sort of the learnings along the way help you as you join this crazy clean tech world. And we'll cover a little bit more about sort of the business side of things. But yeah, I'd like to sort of start by looking at the technology, or at least the broader sense of things, because there's so much focus and finance at the moment going towards renewable electricity, batteries and the grid and mobility transitions. And that's brilliant. All of that is very good. But so much of our climate impact is due to heating. So I just wanted to perhaps get a little feel from yourself, Michael, in terms of why you feel that despite it being perhaps one of the biggest challenges, heat gets a lot less focus, particularly in the mainstream.
Yeah. I think that there's the psychology of it, I'm not sure, but you know, my guess is that people assume the world is getting hotter, and sometimes think that means we're not going to need heat. I don't know, it really is an ignored area, and you know, really. So for Dandelion, that was very much the start of the company. So much effort going into renewable sources of electricity, which are terrific, except for the fact that electric heating tends to be quite inefficient. And so, you know, we started to look at geothermal as a way, or ground source heat pumps, as a way to really address sustainable heating. And, I think one of the things that is telling is that, you know, it's an older technology that we feel like we've optimized quite a bit. But there really aren't a lot of competitors for efficient, sustainable heat in colder climates. And so, that's one of the things that, you know, we've been so excited about within the business, is we just really think that, you know, while there may be, you know, if you're in, I don't know, a temperate part of California, you know, there may be multiple solutions. We really think that for colder climates where a lot of us live, geothermal's got to be a big part of what we do.
Yeah, yeah. And I think sometimes people lose track of the fact as well, because clearly there are some parts of the world where getting warm is really a big issue, the UK being one of them. But even in hotter climes, and, you know, talking to the friends down in sort of Texas, but geothermal and heat pumps generally are good for cooling as well as heating, which perhaps we'll touch on when we look a bit more into your technology.
That's right. Geothermal, the way we think about it is... it eliminates 80% of the energy needed to heat a home, but it also eliminates 30% of the energy needed to cool a home. And, you know, we've seen, frankly, a lot of developers, even in places like Texas, start to incorporate geothermal into their communities. And it's a big part, in our view, of the future resiliency of the grid that, you know, I think... One of the things people sometimes overlook is, you know, in many ways, geothermal is an energy efficiency technology. And the best thing that we can do really is going to be to reduce the amount of energy we need across the board. And geothermal potentially has a very large role to play.
Certainly does that. But let's look at certainly sort of geothermal or ground source, depending on which part of the world you're in, and increasingly air source heat pumps as well, which we perhaps we'll touch on in terms of potentially a competitive technology, have been installed at a pretty good rate in certain parts of Europe, less so in the UK, certainly more so, funnily enough, in Scandinavia and sort of continental Europe. What's the market like in the US? Is this an established technology, or what's the sort of the base level of understanding and interest in geothermal?
Yeah, so I would say it's it's a newer market in some ways. So for a long time, this has been something that if you lived in a rural area where perhaps you had a lot of land and were okay with, you know, a lattice work of trenches, that geothermal might be a good option. Or it was something that, frankly, if you were very wealthy, you might consider largely for reasons of sustainability and signaling rather than cost.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what we've really been focused on is making geothermal more affordable so that it is, you know, the type of decision that pencils out and makes sense from a financial point of view. And then for us, the area we've focused has really been on retrofitting homes that use fuel oil and propane. And I'm always shocked by how many there are. So in the northeast of the United States, there are 5.6 million homes that use fuel oil and propane for heat. Just in New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, there are 2.6 million homes. And so, you know, really what we've been focused on is convincing those consumers that, you know, there's a cheaper, cleaner, more sustainable option that can add value to their homes.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Certainly, I know in the UK, from my limited experience with heat pumps, there's large areas of the UK and obviously some parts of rural continental Europe as well, where people are, again, using propane, LNG or oil, you know, heating oil. And apart from the environmental cost, which is significant, just the financial cost is nothing to be sneezed at.
That's right. And like, you know, no one, we haven't encountered many customers who tell us things like, oh, I really love my fuel oil company and I can't bear to part ways with them. So, you know, it's inconvenient as well. And I actually think that it's something that is changing at a macro level, because 20 years ago, our response to, you know, the statement, well, there are a lot of homes with fuel oil or propane, would be, well, look, we're just going to extend the natural gas grid to them and we'll make those investments and, you know, and that will be their source of heating. And I think that there's been a rethink of that, which has been really, frankly, constructive. And the rethink has been both on the part of utilities and on the part of their regulators, because, you know, the utilities expect to earn a rate of return on those assets for 80 to 100 years, which kind of begs the question, well, are we still going to be using fossil fuels to heat our homes in 80 to 100 years?
Yeah, well, certainly let's hope not. So we have a pretty savvy audience on the podcast here, but it'd be really good if you could share a little bit of the technology about geothermal broadly and how specifically, or how the Dandelion product or system is different, and how you've been able to reduce costs and the ease of installation.
Yeah, so so geothermal, and you know, this is where the ground source heat pumps term can be more precise. You know, so there's a version of geothermal that's utility scale. You go down seven kilometers to find a pocket in the Earth's magma. That's not what we do. What we're doing is we're using the constant temperature of the Earth, which is about 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit, and using that as a source of heat exchange. So we drill a small hole in the backyard. It goes on average about 370 feet down into the earth.
Okay.
It's 4¾ inches in diameter. And we insert into that an HDPE pipe filled with water and glycol, and that serves as a source of heat exchange. And so the idea is that in the wintertime, when it's cold out, you're bringing up that 50 to 55 degree temperature, and then it connects to the ground source heat pump inside the home. And then the ground source heat pump, you know, uses compression to heat the air further and distribute it throughout the home.
Mm-hmm.
And then it operates in the reverse in the summer, brings the heat out of the home and down into the ground, and then brings that cool air or that cool water back up. So, you know, that's kind of the basics of what geothermal is. It's a very, frankly, stable system because the temperature of the ground is stable. It's not a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the way we looked at it, we really looked at three parts of the problem. You know, first is that the amount of loop you need, the amount of the ground loop, is really it's a direct result of how conductive the soil is.
Yeah.
So, you know, mud or granite or, you know, different kinds of shale are going to have different conductivities. And so if you can know how conductive the soil is, you can be more precise about the amount of loop you put in. And, you know, many contractors, for reasons that I totally understand, just really oversize these systems because they don't know what's in the ground, and that drives the cost way up. So we've gotten very good at anticipating what type of soil conditions we're going to find. Second is about the equipment. You know, because the status quo in the industry had been, you know, more either commercial jobs or, you know, affluent residential or rural residential, the equipment is just massive that they'd been using. You're talking water well rigs that are 50,000 pounds, have a 43-foot turning radius. And so that's not going to be welcomed in most most backyards. And so, you know, we've really shrunk the equipment down to make it so that we can access, you know, a more typical suburban home. And so that's been a big part of what we brought to the market. And then, you know, the third part that's really critical is we only install heat pumps that have monitoring capabilities, that, you know, that is their Internet of Things, you know, data is coming off of them. And that's that's important for a number of reasons. You know, it's important today because it allows us to, you know, improve our own modeling and make sure we're doing things correctly. It allows us, when a customer needs service, to respond quickly. And, you know, sometimes we're able to say, well, you know, it looks like the airflow is a little low. When was the last time you changed the air filter? But then, you know, the thing that I think is going to be really important about that is it's going to unlock in the future third-party ownership models, which have been a big part of the solar industry's success. Right. So, you know, we're sort of laying the groundwork for that.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And it was interesting, I'll touch on in a moment, that when I had my solar business, that we would often be able to tell people they had a problem before they knew it themselves in their home by this monitoring and preemptive, which really surprised a lot of them. So touching on that, again, some of the audience will know that formerly I did start a renewable energy installer, an EPC business. Mostly we were focused on solar and small wind, but we did occasionally install air source heat pumps for clients, not ground source, for some of the reasons you just touched on in terms of the difficulty and the size of the equipment. But if we look at the difference, or what are the pros and cons potentially between a geothermal or a ground source heat pump versus an air source heat pump, because we do get a lot of traction or do start to see more of these kind of AC looking boxes outside a lot more homes these days. What are the pros and cons in your mind of the two options?
Yeah, well, I mean, let me start by saying I am a fan of electrification generally. And so, you know, I don't have any quarrel with air source heat pumps. And, you know, I think that can be the right choice in a lot of places and for a lot of homes. We look at it a couple ways. So, like, the air source heat pumps are cheaper to install because you don't have to worry about the ground loop. That's a big factor. Yeah. That means your upfront cost is going to be lower. Ground source heat pumps tend to have greater efficiency over the long term because they can use the ground loop as a source of heat exchange. So, you know, over the long run, obviously climate dependent, you know, we think for many, many homes, ground source is potentially, you know, a better investment. And then, you know, really where I think that becomes dramatic is around winter peaks in particular. So the reason for the increased efficiency of ground source via air source, and the reason I mention it around winter in particular, is just because the delta in temperature is greatest. So, you know, the hottest day is the difference in temperature between your desired in-home temperature is just much less than the coldest day in the difference in temperature. And so ground source heat pumps, or where air source heat pumps can can surprise people in a negative way is that when it gets really cold, they have to augment their heat with essentially electric resistance heating inside the air source heat pump. So in a colder climate on the coldest days, you know, it's going to be running as a mix of electric resistance and air source, which is going to reduce the efficiency. So, you know, with that said, like, you know, I think in a lot of places it's going to be a terrific solution, and I want to see them get traction, because I think advances in air source heat pumps are going to only help us. But at the same time, I think particularly, you know, in colder climates for retrofits, ground source is going to make sense. And then more broadly in new construction, when you have the chance to get the infrastructure in the ground early, you know, I think ground source has been underutilized.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's an interesting point you pick about the sort of the delta or the median temperature, which is interesting, because as you say, heat pumps are tremendously efficient, but where you have where the gap is significantly higher in terms of ambient air temperature versus ambient ground temperature, the additional work obviously affects the efficiency. But yeah, it's great to see that both technologies have their place, but with the installation ease, or the easier installation, and also I think drilling down, because one of the issues that we came across and often was the thought or the consumers' sort of research showing that in terms of loops, there was the ability to essentially create a permafrost and for the soil not to regenerate its heat, which clearly is much more difficult or perhaps even impossible in a drill or in a sort of a drilled solution.
Well, you know, that's so we've encountered that concern. I would say not so much from homeowners, but more from, you know, engineers, and you know, that's actually one of the things we've really investigated and are constantly looking at, because, you know, I think you know, a lot of the equations that are used for sizing ground loops typically assume a more commercial setup, where you may have a lot of ground loops that are close to each other, and I think perhaps therefore have a greater potential to impact the, you know, the temperature of the soil on an ongoing basis. Whereas with residential, we think, you know, again, we don't model it this way out of conservatism, but we think that's less likely, because you know, you're looking at 1 to 2 boreholes, and so, you know, the likelihood therefore is that you're not permanently changing the soil temperature. But it is something we are quite curious about.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so returning a little bit back to your story and to the business as a whole, many, if not most, of our guests are founders in the businesses they run, but you, like many of our guests, or some of our guests also, have sort of come in as a CEO into an established, or, you know, early stage but still an established team. So aside from the small matter of a global pandemic, what were the greatest challenges since you came into the business at the start of 2020?
Yeah, you know, so, like, I think the way, so where Dandelion was in 2019 is, you know, we had been successful in proving that this was something people wanted, that we could sell this, and that frankly we could sell it at a rate that would outstrip our ability to actually install these systems. And so the thing we've been most focused on has really been just increasing our operational capacity. And so that has been a question really of, you know, for us, number one, really number one, two, and three is increasing the amount of drilling that we're able to do, increasing the efficiency of the drilling. But then also, you know, obviously, like, doing more heat pump installations faster at a higher quality level. And then, you know, the third thing that we've really focused on over the last year has just been really bringing a lot of customer centricity to the business. It's very natural when you design something and install it to feel like, well, you know, look, we got it. You know, we did it right. We did it the right way. All our numbers penciled out. And, you know, one of the things that we've sort of accepted within the business is that, you know, there's just no such thing as a three-star review when you're changing the heating and cooling of someone's home. They're either going to love you or they're going to hate you. And so it's actually kind of liberating to know that, because then it's like, okay, as soon as they're concerned, you have to be responsive and thoughtful and take it seriously. And that's made a big difference for us.
Yeah. Yeah. So bringing that to the table, I guess the other thing is, again, during the pandemic, the management of the team, I don't know how large the organization was when you joined, but that clearly has been a struggle for most people, not least of which when you're coming fresh into a business. And on top of that, you were fundraising last year, or I guess you were sort of involved in that because there was a round that closed out earlier this year. So how did you balance those hats whilst those other three factors were playing underneath as well?
Yeah. You know, like, so the being virtual part was difficult, but I feel like we got used to it. It's like, I think in particular for the managers within the company, it's we've all gotten better at Zoom and all gotten better at now the idea of someone joining a video conference call with their camera off seems like almost offensive. You know, it's like, we all know the value of the nonverbal communication. We've also just put a priority on spending time together virtually. So just like teams having unstructured time, and it's not the same as being in person, but it helps because I think the thing you most risk losing is kind of the half thought, right? Like the thing that's like, it's someone doesn't really have the full idea, but they have a concern or they have the seed of an idea. And, you know, getting those expressed, I think, is really important. And so that's something we've really tried to find ways to enable. And then, you know, within our crews, it's been a challenge, frankly, because, you know, they're having to wear masks and we have people in person, and we have had some cases of COVID that have not been great, so thankfully everyone's come out the other end healthy, but you know, that's certainly been a challenge. And then, you know, on the fundraising side, a big part of what we did in the second half of the year, and or at least what I did, there too, you can get to know people via video. Like, I still haven't, we were very lucky to get an investment from Breakthrough Energy Ventures. I feel like I know Libby and Matt, who led the investment, pretty well, but I've never met them in person. So I suppose I don't know how tall they are. I think, frankly, we're at a very lucky time, and I hope it's not a lucky time. I hope it's a permanent time in cleantech where there's legitimate interest in the space from investors. I've done this enough to know that, like, you know, cleantech was hot a decade ago. And then it wasn't hot. And in fact, it was the opposite of hot. It was like no one wanted to touch it. I hope it stays hot because I think we really need it. But I think the thing that's encouraging is I think investors have come to the conclusion that there's just going to be fundamental change in how energy is delivered. And that's such a massive part of the economy that they'd be fools not to invest in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we've seen a very strong deal flow once the first few months of the pandemic got out of the way, where people were clearly preserving cash and looking after their portfolio companies. I think from last summer onwards, we saw the deal flow being turned back on, and if anything, accelerated because of the drivers that we'll perhaps touch on in a moment. But a lot of VCs in particular are committed to clean tech now, and as you say, see it more as a long-term rather than a short-term opportunity, which is clearly exactly what it is and what it needs to be to avoid those peaks and troughs and booms and busts we saw, as you say, about 10, 12 years ago. You've obviously raised that cash now. There's a lot always that you can do with money. Do you have plans to internationalize the business or adapt the business model to maybe license your technologies overseas? Or what's the sort of the growth trajectory like?
Yeah, so I think internationalization, like I joke, we're just aspiring to become regional at this point. So you know, we would love to, you know, to be able to have the business grow international. I think that's some distance in the future for us, unless you include Canada as international. But, you know, I think there are a few things we're really focused on. So, like, you know, one is, yes, you know, what I refer to as like an asset light business model, where we're not doing all the labor ourselves, and so that we're handing a playbook to others. That's something we want to develop. Second is new construction. So Lennar is one of our investors. They're the largest home builder in the U.S. We're very interested in, you know, seeing if we can sort of find the right value proposition for folks who are building new homes, whether it's, you know, 10 homes at a time or 100 homes at a time.
Yeah.
Then third is really on the financing side. So, you know, if you look at solar, third-party ownership models have just been a big part of how they really proved the asset class and got to much better financing rates. So, you know, that's something we plan to launch probably next year, that we're building. Yeah, we're putting getting everything in order for it this year, and quite bullish on that. And then the last thing is really, we want to focus just on some fundamental R&D around the heat pump itself. And in particular, we're very interested in seeing if we can create a heat pump that, you know, to the, you know, to a home that's being retrofitted looks a lot more like a furnace. And, you know, what I mean by that is really like, you know, distributes air at a similar velocity and temperature. Because, you know, we find that for a lot of homes that, you know, could potentially be retrofit, the ductwork is a barrier. And so that's, I don't know if we'll succeed on that, but that's something we're really excited to explore.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm not sure the market is, again, not so much in the UK, but certainly in Scandinavia and large parts of Europe, underfloor heating is has always, regardless of the source of that heat, has been something which is quite prevalent and works clearly very well for any form of heat pump. Is that the case in the US? Is that a thing?
There's some of it. It tends to be kind of a luxury product. And the thing that there's more of, and that tends to be water is usually what is conducting the heat. The thing that there is more of is just hot water radiators. And that's another thing that we're quite interested in being able to offer.
Right. Going back to the optimism around clean tech, and it's something clearly we share as hopefully the most of our audience, but particularly at the moment, we've seen in the Europe, in the EU, Green Deal stimulus packages, and of course, with the new Biden administration, lots of really positive noises, both around stimulus package and, of course, the infrastructure plan, which, fingers crossed, goes through the Senate. What do you hope to see from a policy perspective to support geothermal or heat pumps in the US and beyond?
Yeah, first of all, like, I'm a little bit of a skeptic by nature, and so I'm like wearing these uncomfortable but actually quite soft and well-fitting clothes of an optimist around policy right now. I'm experiencing a little cognitive dissonance, but I'm happy to be experiencing it. So, you know, for geothermal, there are a couple things that are critical. You know, one is the ITC, or the investment tax credit, which has been, you know, a really, I think, successful policy initiative in the U.S. And so, you know, we want to see that extended so that it's not 2 years here, 2 years there, and there's talk of doing it for 10 years. We think that would be terrific. The administration has also talked about doing the ITC, where the tax credit itself can be eligible for a rebate or direct payment. And that's important too, because not every household is gonna be tax credit eligible. And so, you know, one of the things that, say, Sunrun has done, for instance, is, you know, they've figured out how to monetize the tax equity, but that tax equity, about 20% of it goes to the bankers who are executing those transactions, and so there's a lot of value lost along the way. So we think that could be good. The third thing, which is a rather specific point for geothermal, is we want to see parity under Section 48A, and that's really for, again, about the third-party ownership. So for reasons, I don't fully understand why it was set up this way, but, if for a customer today, you get a 26% tax credit for solar, you also get a 26% tax credit for geothermal. But if you're a third party, like the company or a builder, for solar, it's 26%. For geothermal, it's 10%. That's a big difference, and that really changes the incentives for those who would, maybe to offer a specific example, like Lennar has told us, we want to sell a home. We don't want to sell a home and a tax credit. I think the third party ownership can help make it really simpler for customers. So those are the big things we're focused on around the ITC. I think there's going to be a lot of other potentially really beneficial stuff that may come out as well. In particular, I'm thinking of workforce retraining. I think one of the challenges frankly, liberals have had is that, what happens to good jobs has always just been this, magical, unanswered question. We have, classic blue collar jobs that we need skilled laborers to do, and they pay well. I'm hopeful there's going to be some investment in developing those skills for those people.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope so. And we've all seen globally for reasons in and around the pandemic, so many jobs impacted negatively. But I think it's really important that we can take this opportunity to, as you say, reskill and put people to work and give them the opportunity to work in areas where there's a future and B, a good living to be had. And certainly one of the benefits, I think, of clean technologies broadly are that we can be cost comparative, but equally we can employ more people. I mean, it doesn't take that many people to be running a dirty old fossil fuel plant, relatively speaking, to the output. So, I think jobs in the US and across the world really is a factor which hopefully people will, as you say, seize the opportunity to connect those dots.
Well, and, I feel like one of the awful ironies of our business is the single hardest role for us to hire is a driller. And you would think that, in the U.S., that would be, the easiest role, because there are all these, oil and gas drillers who are out of work right now, and we could put them to work. But it really is the most challenging role, and it's such a good example of, the skills gap is very small, and it's more about, awareness and connecting to them. And, I think there's a lot to be gained with focus in that area.
Yeah, yeah. No, huge amounts of optimism and positivity. And I think broadly, last year, I think, was challenging for all of us, not just the pandemic, but clearly, shall we say, some of the administrations in the US and around the world were not necessarily on the side of the Paris Agreement and a lot of good stuff. So hopefully this year is more optimistic. We've already touched on, fundraising for yourselves and other companies has turned on. So let's hope there's good cause to be broadly optimistic that we can take some big leaps and forward in terms of the energy and mobility transitions. Are you broadly positive, negative? Where do you stand on the sort of us getting to a point where we can really, avoid some of the worst catastrophes that we've seen some of in California, for example, and elsewhere around the world?
I would guess my answer to that is that I try not to allow pessimism to set in, because I think that that's just, such a dangerous place to be. I don't accept that that this change is inevitable. And I think that we have all the tools at our disposal, I hope, to remedy it. And so I guess I would say that I am quite deliberately optimistic about it. I think we don't have a choice but to be optimistic, because I think, you know, if you get pessimistic, then you know it's going to happen, right?
Yes.
I mean, pessimism
yes.
just leads to, can lead to resignation. And I really think we can make a difference here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. One of the things I love about this podcast and the work I do, obviously, with Hyperion is just working with clean tech companies who are able to make an impact. As you say, I think the technologies, clearly they will improve and there will be new ones coming down the line. But with what we have at the moment, we can do this. It's just a case of entrepreneurs and founders and VCs and everybody playing their part. And obviously some policy help along the way would not go without appreciation. It's been really great to talk to you, Michael. Finally, I love to it's a really great deal and do a lot of listening to podcasts, as you'd expect. Are there any either books, podcasts, thought leaders, media of any description that has inspired you or continues to inspire you in your journey?
Yeah, I think, I'm a sucker for macro histories, and I really enjoyed The Weirdest People in the World, which is a book about how the West is sort of psychologically peculiar. And the part of why I've found it inspiring is that it's so much of what we take as assumptions, like things that seem natural to us, are in fact just like cultural ramifications. And so I've really enjoyed that. On the podcast front, my recommendation is, and admittedly, it may be a very male one, is I really love Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. And I am not a military history buff at all. But what I, sort of similar to what I mentioned with The Weirdest People in the World, he does a wonderful job of sort of approaching things from first principles and asking, how did people end up in this situation?
Yeah.
I feel like we don't ask those questions enough.
Yeah, no, I think critical thinking is something that's very much amiss these days. So, brilliant. Appreciate those couple of recommendations. We'll put those on the episode page on the website for this episode, along with obviously links to Dandelion. And there's a really cool video actually that I did look at earlier on your website around, one of your installations. So, for people to have a look at how your rigs are slightly different and how you've been able to do installations, as you say, in those more sort of compact areas. So, we'll put links to all of that on the podcast webpage. And really enjoyed talking to you. I hope you continue success, and hope to see you reaching beyond regional elsewhere in the US and beyond. But geothermal clearly is something which we need to, we need to throw everything at this problem, don't we? And it's another great tool in our armory. So I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, thanks, David. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciate what you do. So keep doing it.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that foray into geothermal and heat pumps. Please do keep your feedback and suggestions coming. And thank you to those of you who have been writing reviews. If you haven't and you have 5 minutes to spare, any review or recommendation is very much appreciated to keep the podcast out there and keep our stories and keep the cleantech world informed of some of the things that are going on. As ever, really appreciate your time and your subscribing to the podcast. I hope to speak to you again soon.